longer as oxygen becomes a scarcer resource. It's the sort of training that works best in the company of world-class swimmers who are paying attention to every awkward stroke. The dangers, after all, are real. Getting someone out of the pool quickly if they go floppy, as Hamilton calls it, is something that they always have to be ready for. Of the people in the pool that day, though, only one person has a reputation for consistently pushing things too far. After I swim until my muscles scream for a rest, I sit on the side to recover. Hamilton points down to Orlando Bloom, who is still swimming along the bottom of the pool in goggles and a blue latex cap. There is some obscenely large piece of metal in his hand. We always have to keep a special eye on Bloom. Just about every time he's up here, he goes floppy at some point in the routine, he says, adding that the episodes are so frequent that they even have their own nickname. We call them Bloomouts. It's sort of funny, but there's a real potential for danger. If someone is trying these particular exercises without supervision, it would be pretty easy for them to reach the limit of human endurance and simply pass out in the water. While that might be okay with a landlubber's breathwork, the consequences are much more severe underwater, where a gasp means drowning. But if I can get beyond that, and under Hamilton's gaze, I am hopeful that I can, then perhaps I'm able to force the wedge just a little bit deeper between my mind and my body. In any event, the weight exercises are surprisingly low impact. Most people leave Hamilton's workouts refreshed rather than exhausted. Part of the reason could be he demands that everyone who attends also conditions their body with alternating ice baths and sauna sessions. He shows me a hidden alcove between the pool and his mansion where he keeps an outdoor ice bath and his ice machine. You have to stay in for at least 3 minutes, he says, gesturing to the aluminum contraption that looks like a cross between a cattle trough and an industrial milk tub. So I get in and feel the frigid water close around me. As I cool in the ice, I eye some sort of churning device at the end of the tub. When it's on, it keeps the water in constant motion. The moving water prevents the body heat from forming a small, insulating layer of warmish water when a person remains still. It would be much colder if I were to turn it on. I had the illusionist David Blaine out here a few months ago, Hamilton says. He said that he could last 15 minutes in the ice with no problem, but I turned on the circulator and he had to jump out in just 2 minutes. I lay back and close my eyes. The ice feels good. I stay put for 5 minutes, and when I turn it on, the circulator changes the calculus of ice bathing. It takes a lot more focus to stay warm. Hamilton heard about the Wim Hof method through a 10-week online course on Hof's Inner Fire website. For Hamilton, using the cold makes sense. He grew up swimming in the tropical waters around Oahu. Hypothermia was always a present danger. Even warm Pacific waters slowly leach away the heat from submerged swimmers. And for people waiting around on a surfboard for just the right set of waves without a wetsuit, it's easy for them to end up shivering uncontrollably. Yet Hamilton can spend half a day in the water and says that controlling his temperature is half the reason he has any success riding big waves. One thing about waves and the cold is that there's no discrimination, no mercy or grudges. There are no opinions or intent when they take their toll on a person. They just do what they do. They will never surprise you, and their baselines never really change. They're forces of nature, he says. The forces he's contending with aren't prone to the whims of human irregularity, nor is there a persona that guides how they react. Nature doesn't care how you feel about it. When a person's temperature drops to the point where the brain becomes cloudy and decision-making sputters, the ocean will not relent. Yet, it has no malice when it takes a life. Hof's training represents a way to counter that indifference, and with it, Hamilton can stay warmer in the water. As a constant tweaker of workout routines, Hamilton has also found a few ways to eke out just a little more performance out of the Wim Hof method. While ice and sauna immersion between underwater routines improve the circulatory muscles in his vascular system, Hamilton has modified the breathing method to help him excel at endurance events on land. The way he explains it, every workout has an ultimate limit where the physical load of an exercise increases the heart rate, and accordingly, respiration goes up to compensate until the body simply runs out of oxygen and the movement stops. This basic concept of biomechanics dictates that as the body moves, a person needs more oxygen to fuel the motion. Exhaustion is just the inevitable result of what happens when breathing hits its maximum rate and the body can't get enough energy into the system. This is what physical trainers call VO2 max. When you hit this moment of peak performance, it's simply not possible for you to push any further. We've all been at this point at some time or another. Your face is flushed red and your chest is heaving, but try as you might, you know that in a second or two, you're going to crash. Peak performance at VO2 max is partly based on genetics, as everyone has a slightly different ability to metabolize oxygen. Yet, Hamilton assures me that exhaustion like this isn't only a mechanical problem, it's also a conceptual one. If you have to stop to catch your breath, then you probably started the race all wrong in the first place, he tells me. Instead, if you lead with a breathing pattern like you're already at your maximum load, then you won't have to work so hard later. He tells me to think of it this way. The body has an internal program that automatically evaluates and responds to the conditions it is working in, but it doesn't have any way to know on its own what sort of oxygen load that it is going to need in the future. It responds to the workload of the moment. When a sudden spike in heavy exertion happens, the body has to play catch-up. When you don't plan for breathing in a workout, it's easy to end up with an oxygen deficit. The solution is to start breathing hard long before you actually feel the need to. The most obvious application for this technique is with running. A typical adult takes about 15 breaths every minute when they are at rest, but will start breathing at 40 to 50 breaths per minute during periods of intensive exercise until they hit their VO2 max. An untrained runner will breathe faster as they reach their limit, but they typically draw shallow breaths that don't give their lungs a chance to maximize oxygen absorption. By anticipating what the body is going to do, Hamilton says that anyone can tweak their physiology for better performance. To demonstrate, Hamilton shows me the breathing pattern he uses to lead into his workouts. His lips bulge stiffly outwards, and his eyes narrow to slits as he sucks in air coarsely through his nose. Waiting just long enough for his lungs to fully draft, he exhales a growl reminiscent of Maori warriors as they perform a haka. Taking a breath every second makes him sound like he is under heavy labor. His face flushes with exertion, but his eyes have the serene gaze of a mind focusing only on the action of its lungs. After 50 breaths, he inhales deeply and is ready to run. The process scrubs carbon dioxide from his lungs, allowing his body to run more efficiently for a short period of time, in the same way that the Hof breathing method allows someone to do more push-ups than they expect to, or, if he were to keep it up, throughout the duration of the longer exertion. Hamilton begins every morning with 20 minutes of this sort of breathing. He says it helps him get ready for the day and clears his mind for the tasks that he has in front of him. Once he's in the pool, usually by 7:30, he does a quick round of breathing for a few minutes before starting underwater laps. Technically, hyperventilating and swimming underwater can pose a serious danger of blacking out and drowning, even for expert swimmers. Since the body is designed to sense CO2 levels in the blood, not the presence of oxygen, a breath hold diver who has expelled CO2 out of his lungs has very little warning when his actual oxygen levels are seriously low. Free divers generally stay away from this sort of technique for their deep water plunges, and the U.S. Diving Manual issues stern warnings to any military personnel who attempt it without proper safety protocol in place. Which is why when I joined Hamilton in a series of breath hold laps in his pool with three of his friends for the following morning session, I am wary of what might happen if I or someone else goes floppy. To his credit, Hamilton recognizes that what we are doing today carries a risk of blacking out in the shallow end of his pool. So we are going to have to stay close together and be hyper aware of how everyone else is doing in case someone needs to exit the pool quickly. Today's session is an experiment, and one that he is not sure will get incorporated into the canon of XPT. The five of us face off on alternate sides of the pool's shallow end, with three on one side and two on the other. The plan is to do three rounds of breathing and breath holds, and then dive underwater with empty lungs and do as many laps as we can. "There's something different about swimming with no air in your lungs," says Hamilton. "You might not go as far, but you pass out in a different way. It's slower." Perhaps this is because the goal of swimming with empty lungs isn't about extending the length of time underwater, as much as it is about expanding the wedge between your conscious mind and your body's actual limits. Since the body will process oxygen in the bloodstream and then expel waste CO2 back into the lungs, the body may have a chance to sense CO2 buildup before actually blacking out. In Wim's terminology, breath-out exercises primarily work on the sympathetic nervous system, the fight-or-flight responses. Breath-in exercises first trigger parasympathetic responses and might make a person more inclined to relax before the sympathetic responses kick in. We swim between each other like interlocking fingers, and I easily reach the opposite side and flip around for a return lap. I remember a warning Hamilton gave me earlier not to try to sprint underwater, but instead to take every stroke slowly and conserve my resources. I kick out to the alternate wall, just a little slower than my first pool length. I can see that the others are headed for a third lap, so I plunge ahead with them. Hamilton's blue bathing suit flickers past with fish-like efficiency. Three lengths down, I turn and head into the fourth lap with darkening senses. Four strokes later, I can feel something shaking deep within me. I've been underwater for about a minute, and I want to breathe, but instead, I let out some of the CO2 that has built up in my lungs. It is enough to enable me to finish the lap, but when I come to the surface, the world feels a little darker than it had a minute or two earlier. I grasp the edge of the pool and close my eyes. I take a single deep breath and then hold it. The shake that is welling up in me grows a little stronger, and soon a shudder rocks through to my core. Then, as I gaze out into the starry blackness behind my lids, I see a sunburst of reds and yellows. I can feel the pool tile beneath my forearms as my head bobs down. The fireworks hang in the black void for a moment and begin to transform into a shape that resembles a human face with two black slits for eyes and a halo of flame around them. The image stays for a second before I take another breath and open my eyes. Darian Olian, a nutritionist who is a regular at Hamilton's pool, completes two more laps after I come up for air. He is breathing hard and has his arm around Hamilton's steely-jawed nephew, a professional stand-up paddleboarder from San Diego. They both hunch against the wall. All of us pushed ourselves to the edge and slipped into some sort of exercise-induced transcendence. It is not uncommon to hallucinate during longer breath holds. The deprivation of oxygen peels back layers of the brain, shutting them down until you reach a sort of primal center of human existence. The brain's electrical patterns fire in sporadic ways as a person begins to lose consciousness. The process is rooted in our basic biology. But for Hamilton, the experience has deeper meaning than just a physical reaction. "Breathing lets you go deep," he says to me later, describing how his 20-minute morning routine of deep breathing and breath holding has led him to places he never expected he would reach. "Sometimes I'll see a face looking back at me, and I know it's my own soul. At other times, it feels like I'm floating above my body, looking down at myself while meditating." The face he sees most, he says, resembles the crude features of the comic book hero, the Silver Surfer, something that is otherworldly, yet also human. I am not entirely surprised that the deity he identifies with most owns a surfboard. It is open to debate whether what I've seen on the edge of unconsciousness is a connection to something that truly transcends the world we live in, or is instead the machinations of a hypoxic mind attempting to create meaning out of meaningless physical phenomenon. Clinical literature often reports different types of hallucinations that can occur during meditation. And in most cases, the experiences don't correlate with an underlying mental health condition. In India and China, yogis who use similar breathing techniques called pranayama in Sanskrit, or qi breathing in Mandarin, frequently report experiencing visions. In fact, most Eastern traditions believe that breath control can engender profound spiritual insights. For Hamilton, and indeed, many people who delve deeply into their own physiology through meditation or yoga, there is an intrinsic connection between the body and the soul, and every such experience has the potential to open a window into something greater. Whatever it means, just like a dream, the experience itself is real. Also real, of course, is the possibility of actually passing out underwater. If I had gone a little farther, another lateral lap of the pool, the vision could have been a precursor to my mind shutting down and fainting. In unconsciousness, my autonomic nervous system would take over and my lungs would have filled with water. Shortly after the session was over, Hamilton gets in touch with me to say that they aren't going to mix breath work and water work anymore. While the underwater laps are interesting, the risks that come along with them just aren't worth it. He thinks it will be better to keep that part of the training on dry land. Whether or not Hamilton needs to find out the ultimate truth of what happens to us after we die, I suspect that his faith in something greater than himself has helped him get through the potentially fatal situations where he finds himself during his adventures on the water. Peek at any dozens of the videos online of a pea-sized Hamilton being towed to the apex of a rogue wave and then disappearing down its vertical walls. Then try to visualize your own feet on his surfboard. The crushing energy of that water exposes everything in its path to the gargantuan forces of nature. In the face of which, all of a human's dreams, goals, and ambitions are insignificant. The wave doesn't care if you live or die. Accepting the sheer mercilessness of nature is the key to riding a big wave in the first place. A few hours after our pool routine, I sit with Hamilton outside his Malibu Hills home overlooking the ocean. He squints his eyes at a distant storm cloud as I ask him about how he faces the probability of death before dropping into a wave. "You ride a wave. You don't conquer it," Hamilton says. "The trick to surviving is knowing when you're outmatched." In part, he credits his achievements as a surfer to what is for him a humble connection to nature, and the realization that he is not just the rider of a wave, but indeed that a surfer is part of the wave. "There is no beginning and no end of a wave," Hamilton says. "Instead, there's a sort of timeless aspect to surfing, where every wave you're ever on is part of the same eternal wave. Really good surfers have a connection to the ocean, where the great waves simply come to them. Surfers who fight the ocean and try to defeat it never connect, and aren't given good waves. Even so, it might not be fair to say that the five people who have died on Tihapu since Hamilton rode the Millennium Wave weren't connected with the ocean. Wipeouts and injuries are so common in his business that Hamilton stopped counting the stitches he's sewn into his flesh after they surpassed 1,000. He's broken ribs and his fingers, blown out his eardrums, and had the tip of an errant surfboard plunge through the flesh of his cheek. All of this is to say that he's no stranger to the consequences of failure. The key to success for Hamilton is embracing the possibility of crashing, or even death. Everything he tries starts out with a plan of what failure might look like. It's a recipe, he says, that applies to a lot more than just surfing. I ask him to outline what that means. Before he drops into a wave, he envisions a successful ride. He thinks about how he will enter in at just the right angle and, no matter what forces are against him, find a way through it. Once he has that plan in mind, he says, I commit and believe that I will make it. That simple belief is often enough to see him through to the safety of the shore. But even if it doesn't, the attitude of success can pull him forward when things go wrong. In the split second that he realizes that he's lost control, he thinks about what a crash might be like and then plans to minimize the damage. Whether this means rolling into a ball, diving off the board, or whatever else opportunity puts on his doorstep, he believes that there will always be a moment when he will have a semblance of control again. The trick is waiting for it to happen. The swirling currents and crushing forces are, after all, just forces. They ebb and flow and dispassionately dispense opportunities as they do obstacles. During a crash, the water rushes over his body and asserts its will. In the torrent of water, his limbs aren't his own. He'll be smashed by water, rocks, the board he was carrying, and whatever else gets in his way. In these moments of utter powerlessness, Hamilton submits and relaxes. In the eye of the maelstrom, there is nothing to do but let nature run its course. It will either kill him, maim him, or let him go. The Zen during the tumble is humbling and can tick by for breathless minutes. Hamilton's lungs might burn, and his body might be brutalized by the swirl around him. But at some point, he says, if you make it far enough, the grip will loosen. You have to keep your mind still while you are still in the midst of it all, knowing that your chance will come. And when it does let up, Hamilton taps into all of the stored energy in his body to make his move. That's when he lets his fight or flight response take over. He uncoils like a jack-in-the-box and sprints with every shard of energy in his body to reach back toward life. So far, he's made it back alive every time. The rules to this formula, commitment, crash, submission, and escape, provide a blueprint for every failure in his life, he says. It has allowed him to survive the unsurvivable and has given him a guiding philosophy for every venture he gets into outside of the water. It's the attitude I go into before I start a new business or training regimen, he says. Together, they form a wedge that he crams between his consciousness and the autopilot of his own nervous system. It's the division between his own natural limits and the control he can express over the world around him. Hamilton's philosophy mixes spirituality with exercise and environmental conditioning. An outsider might call it holism. Sometimes when I hear this sort of all-encompassing explanation for a universal order, I can't help telegraphing my skepticism. Is one of the world's greatest surfers also a purveyor of California flimflam and fad exercises? An easier explanation for his success, after all, could be that he has had access to the very best training facilities on the West Coast and that he's just been incredibly lucky to survive every death-defying feat. However, Scientific explanations and claims can be equally mysterious. And there's no better illustration of how the holistic world and the scientific world have collided than the recent research gold rush into brown fat. Chapter 7: Swatting Mosquitoes with Hand Grenades. In the past 100 years, the rise of easy calories, climate control, and processed foods have created a global obesity epidemic and an exponential rise in diabetes. In the United States alone, diabetes accounts for $245 billion of annual medical spending. Almost 35% of Americans are obese. And the rest of the world's citizenry isn't much better. 39% of the rest of the planet's population is medically overweight. Footnote: doctors define overweight as a body mass index, or BMI, of 25 or greater. A BMI of 30 or greater is considered obese. We spend fortunes on crash diets, and when they don't work, billions more on kidney transplants and dialysis. We've tried just about everything to bring the crisis to a halt, from inventing drugs that limit the amount of fat the body can absorb, to amphetamines that overclock a person's metabolism, to even intentionally infecting ourselves with tapeworms. Yet none of this has slowed the steady expansion of our collective waistline. Then, in 2011, scientists at Harvard discovered that brown fat wasn't just a vestigial tissue locked away in our evolutionary past, but was something that just about every human has the potential to build and use. It was a ray of hope amidst a bleak and unrelenting epidemic. Within a year, the National Institutes of Health issued a new research directive to help fund basic research into the underlying mechanisms of brown adipose tissue, or BAT, with a simple long-term goal: to create a drug that maximized all the properties of brown fat without requiring someone to spend their time being cold. The first pharmaceutical company to develop a drug that could turn on BAT's fat-sucking properties without changing the sedentary American lifestyle would not only stand to do a great deal of public good, but would make billions of dollars in the process. The race for a miracle drug was on. The first task was to understand exactly how BAT works. Since it was only recently discovered in humans, many of the basic mechanics were still a little hazy. But the broad strokes of the process seemed fairly simple. Once nerve cells in the skin detect a cold environment, they relay a chemical signal through a series of neurons leading to the autonomic centers in the brain with a message to get ready to start generating heat. The brain then has a few potential options to deal with this information. It can simply ignore the signal and calculate that the body's stores of white fat provide sufficient insulation, and because the brain perceives no real threat, it does nothing. Or the brain can trigger various muscles to start shivering and mechanically heat the body. Or it can ramp up the metabolism and tell brown fat to start sucking white fat out of storage and burn it for heat energy. Or it can decide to do a mix of all three of these things. Since sensory nerves relay the signal to the brain, there is also a conscious component. When you feel cold, you perceive it as a slight chill, which might lead your conscious mind to override any autonomic decision-making and instead start some sort of exercise, maybe turn up the thermostat or put on a few additional layers of clothing. No matter what happens, at the most minute level, all the signals and sensations break down into a cascading series of hormone and neurotransmitter releases that stretch from the nerves in the skin all the way to the brain. This then triggers one heating strategy or another. In theory, a drug could short-circuit the brown fat activation process by mimicking the specific neurotransmitter that the brain sends out along this chemical pathway to activate BAT. A person would simply take a pill or an injection, skipping any discomfort that accompanies being cold, and start burning up ordinary white fat. The tricky part is identifying the right series of neurotransmitters and chemical pathways. One company in Boston aims to create a special line of stem cells that will turn white fat cells brown, thereby giving patients enough BAT in their systems to help kickstart passive thermogenesis. A company in Houston believes that they have a promising candidate for a drug that will mimic the correct neurotransmitter to turn on BAT. Meanwhile, researchers in the San Francisco Bay Area have discovered that certain environmental conditions will make the body turn white fat beige, think khaki, by a not yet understood process. Some recent successes are particularly startling. Kevin Phillips, an assistant professor of molecular and cellular biology at Baylor College of Medicine, started thinking about how rodents have a special ability to transform their own stores of white fat into brown fat while preparing for hibernation. Phillips and his team knew that an overactive thyroid gland makes it difficult for people to tolerate heat, while an underactive one makes them especially sensitive to the cold. And he wondered if the key to turning on brown fat lay in the thyroid itself. He created a synthetic thyroid hormone called GC1 that would stimulate production of a protein in brown fat called UCP1, which is a critical component that allows BAT to dismantle white fat cells and turn them into heat. Phillips located mice that had been genetically programmed to be obese. Apparently, made-to-order mice exhibiting just about any condition are easy to come by in the halls of scientific research. And he injected half of them with his experimental compound. Over the course of the next 20 days, mice that received GC1 lost almost half of their white fat, while the control group actually gained weight. To illustrate the change, he published photos of mice in the November 2015 issue of Cell Reports, showing one sad-looking obese furball with its stomach flattening out across a white table beside a trim counterpart almost half its size. Along with the startling weight loss, the mice with active BAT also had an innate ability to resist the cold, where the control group did not. In a cold tolerance test, Phillips put both groups of mice into a refrigerated cage at 39.2 degrees Fahrenheit and measured their body temperature. Over the course of 8 hours, the obese control group's core temperature dwindled into fatal hypothermia. The mice that were dosed with GC1 continued onward for 15 straight hours, apparently no worse for the wear. Phillips published his findings in Cell Reports, and then to great fanfare in the mainstream media, for uncovering what might be a way to bottle brown fat's lightning and give people a simple pharmaceutical miracle pill. He plans to conduct a follow-up study on non-human primates, and then, if all goes well, on to humans. While one day a drug could well hack the body to create stores of brown fat, there is reason to pause before declaring this is a solution to the ailments of the modern world. Any sort of drug, even ones that are very carefully designed by the best researchers on the planet, are clunky, cell-specific delivery mechanisms at best. The communication chains in the nervous system work a little bit like pieces of a puzzle in that one neuron activates its neighboring neuron by excreting a specific chemical directly into the space between them. This space is called a synapse, and this process happens millions of times in sequence with exactly the right locks and keys to activate a predetermined biological process. Drugs try to hack this chain by flooding the entire body with synthetic hormones that mimic the correct chemical shape, but they do so without entering the chain in the correct sequence. Unfortunately, the body has only a finite number of receptors and shapes available to it, and the same protein or neurotransmitter for, say, activating brown fat could also be critical for a wildly different process in another part of the body. Normally, the dearth of chemical shapes isn't a problem, because the pathways are kept separate and individually activated. However, when a drug floods the bloodstream with a non-native molecule, there is no telling where it might end up. Sure, it can find the correct site on the BAT pathway, but but it might also bind to other sites and wreak havoc in the process. In other words, every drug has a potential for side effects. In a way, the drug approach is a little like trying to swat a mosquito with a hand grenade. Sure, a grenade will kill a mosquito, but who knows what else might get caught up in the explosion. Over the course of experimentation and clinical trials, researchers attempt to minimize and rule out potential side effects. But anyone who has read the medical literature on just about any drug on the market knows that there is always potential for unexpected reactions. But there's another reason that the pharmaceutical approach to activating BAT might not work as well as expected, and it has to do with a fundamental rift between most laboratory research and the complexity of human experience. Living things perceive the world through sensation. We feel pressure, cold, pain, and warmth. We can see and hear things, and all of these senses help our minds evaluate the world around us. However, from a medical perspective, there is no way to specifically identify these sensations. In the same way that a microscope or probe can't touch a thought or poke at pain, no scientific method yet developed can bridge the gap between the mind and the body. German philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz described this disconnect quite vividly all the way back in 1714. Consciousness is inexplicable on mechanical principles, i.e., by shapes and movements, Leibniz wrote. If we imagine a machine whose structure makes it think, sense, and be conscious, we can conceive of it being enlarged in such a way that we can go inside it, like a mill. Suppose we do. Visiting its insides, we will never find anything but parts pushing each other. Never anything that could explain a conscious state. The scientific method equates sensations and thoughts to chemical signals and physical processes. This sort of reductionism makes it almost impossible to assign meaning to experiences. Moreover, by focusing so closely on single, isolated neurological pathways, it's possible that this approach misses the confluence of bodily interactions with the environment that, in turn, create the overall biological picture. As Phillips's investigation noticed, the thyroid certainly plays a role in how humans interact with ambient temperatures. Cold can trigger brown fat production, but it can also initiate a number of other responses throughout the body, depending on which biological strategy seems appropriate in the moment. Put another way, even if there are no side effects from a drug that ramps up brown fat, there's no reason to think that brown fat production alone is the only benefit of cold exposure. Wouter van Marken Lichtenbelt, a professor of energetics and health at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, has tried to turn a scientific lens on the question of how humans adapt to different environments. I've been trying to connect with him for several months, but have had very little luck finding a time when our two schedules lined up. When I do manage to eventually locate him through a scratchy cell phone connection, he is riding a bicycle on his daily commute between his home and his laboratory. I can hear the brakes squeal over the connection as he comes to a stop somewhere between a highway overpass. "It's a cave, really," he comments as he peers into its dark recesses. "It appears that I am in the company of bats now." It is a fitting spot. It is winter in Holland, and the bats around him are deep in hibernation. In order to preserve their energy through the winter months, bats and many other small animals don't shiver, but instead warm their bodies by burning up white fat. "I have been interested in non-shivering thermogenesis for almost 10 years, and I have been looking at ways to bottle metabolic lightning at least that long," van Marken Lichtenbelt says. His studies aim to understand the way that the environment alters the body. While pharmaceuticals might be able to target specific bodily processes and tweak them to treat a specific acute ailment, van Marken Lichtenbelt sees the twin epidemics of diabetes and obesity through a thermodynamic lens. Both conditions come from there being too much energy available for the body. When there's too much energy in a system, then that system starts to malfunction. It's a matter of physics. And there are really only three ways to fix it. You can reduce the amount of energy coming into the body, decrease the body's efficiency at absorbing energy, or increase the rate that the body makes use of it. Most diets follow the first line of attack. To lose weight, you can simply decrease your food intake. Working on just the input side of the equation will result in some short-term success. But more often than not, people struggle to restrict their calories and end up regaining their lost pounds over time. Several drugs follow the second line of attack by changing the efficiency with which the body actually processes food. In the 1920s, magazines sold tapeworms for people to ingest and host. With the help of the worm, people could eat whatever they wanted to and still lose weight. But parasites are not the most friendly companions, and this treatment often led to severe anemia and malnutrition. A more recent iteration of the same idea is a drug called Xenical. It sets an artificial limit to the amount of fat that a person can efficiently metabolize. It's what Bill Clinton supposedly used to slim down after a presidential diet of Big Macs. While this drug is effective at curbing the amount of calories a person can absorb, there is a nasty side effect. All the excess energy transforms immediately into an oily waste. In practical terms, this means that just a few extra calories of fat sends patients careening in clenched-legged sprints towards the nearest bathroom. The final option, of course, is ramping up the metabolism. And Van Marken Lichtenbelt believes that the best way to do this is through a combination of exercise and cold acclimation. Diabetes is essentially a condition wherein the body cannot deal with the amount of sugar in its bloodstream. As sugar levels go up, healthy people produce more insulin to control the influx. But people suffering from type 2 diabetes grow resistant to insulin so that their sugar levels rise. This excess sugar wreaks havoc on their insides. Limbs swell, cancerous lesions form, and the extremities become numb. Ultimately, the patient's kidneys are destroyed. Doctors have nicknamed the disease sugar cancer. In 2015, Van Marken Lichtenbelt found 8 overweight men in their late 50s suffering from type 2 diabetes and decided to test them to see how short-term cold exposure would alter their bodies. The men dressed in shorts and sat in a chilly 57-degree Fahrenheit room, the temperature just above the point where they would begin to shiver uncontrollably. They spent 6 hours a day in the cold for 10 straight days as the doctor monitored their insulin production and blood levels. At the end of the study, he put the men into a PET CT scan to measure their levels of BAT. As he suspected, at the end of the study, the men showed enormous improvements in how their bodies metabolized sugar. The cold allowed the men to clear sugar from their blood 43% more efficiently than when they started. In other words, in just under 2 weeks, cold exposure almost reversed the symptoms of diabetes. As one of the pioneering researchers on BAT, Van Marken Lichtenbelt predicted that the metabolic changes would come with a corresponding increase in their BAT levels. But when the results from the PET CT scan came back, it turned out that most of the men had the same levels of BAT as when they entered the study. Cold exposure had changed the men's underlying condition. But the lightning that Van Marken Lichtenbelt was trying to bottle must have come from somewhere else. The only thing that he could conclude was that the men's bodies had discovered a different way to adapt to the cold conditions than what he had anticipated. So, while the study had enormous implications for how to treat diabetes, the underlying mechanisms were still clouded in mystery. The miraculous properties of BAT are just one of the many strategies that the body can rely on to accomplish the same task. An extremely overweight person with a surplus layer of insulating white fat doesn't necessarily need to ramp up their metabolism to fight against the cold. The layer of fat alone suffices to protect against moderate exposure. Footnote. Presumably, the mice that had their BAT activated through the chemical in Philip's laboratory spent a lot longer in the cold than what could be dealt with solely through insulation. People who are already in shape, however, might respond much more quickly to cold temperatures, forcing their bodies to generate BAT in order to stay alive. After a series of biopsies to investigate what other possible mechanisms might have helped his patients, Van Marken-Lichtenbelt discovered that ordinary muscles can also transform under the right conditions and hyperstimulate other cellular mitochondria to accomplish the same results as active BAT. The secrets of the human body are complex and highly dependent on the individual and the method of exposure, even if the results are the same. However, more than anything else, this study shows that while a drug might activate one specific pathway to generate heat energy to burn up excess calories, administering that drug might not be the optimal solution. Instead of stimulating the body with a foreign substance, it is probably more efficient to use the environment to trigger the correct and predictable response. To be fair, Van Marken-Lichtenbelt had some inkling that even though brown fat was potentially important, it was not necessarily the only key to large-scale metabolic change. As seems to be the case with just about every biologist in the Netherlands, early on in his career, he had a chance to study Wim Hof's curious physiology. In what might just be the most profoundly lucky occurrence of happenstance for a researcher investigating the Hof method, it turns out that Hof has a genetically identical twin brother, André. Previous examinations of Wim Hof's physiology had shown that the Iceman himself possesses much more BAT than other people his age. He is about the same amount that a typical 20-year-old does. While Wim Hof is incredibly active, his twin brother isn't. As a truck driver who spends most of his time inside of a heated cab, André lives a mostly sedentary lifestyle. Though they look the same, Van Marken-Lichtenbelt figured that Wim's near-constant exposure to the cold would result in his having much greater amounts of BAT than his twin would. But when the professor put both Wim and André into a PET CT scan, he found that they, remarkably, had very similar, high levels of BAT. Even so, despite their similar biology, Wim's ability to withstand the cold is undoubtedly stronger than his brother's. While BAT likely plays a part in his metabolic robustness, defining the exact underlying mechanisms proves to be a deceptively difficult task. All this, and still, the most striking discoveries on the Wim Hof method don't have anything to do with his metabolism. In 2011, Hof met with Dutch immunologists Peter Pickers and Matthias Cox at Radboud University after making the outrageous claim that he could consciously subdue or ramp up his immune system at will. It was a claim that was, by definition, impossible. The prevailing medical logic at the time held that there was a firewall between the autonomic and somatic nervous systems. The immune system wasn't supposed to be connected to the brain at all. Nonetheless, Cox and Pickers were curious. And if anyone could test Hof's claim, it was them. Until that point, much of Pickers' career had been devoted to developing tests that evaluated the effectiveness of immunosuppressive drugs. While turning off the immune system is not usually a great idea, in some cases, such as when someone gets a kidney transplant and their body might reject the donor organ, or in the face of an aggressive autoimmune disease, there is no other way for a person to survive. In 2011, Cox was Pickers' graduate student, looking to finish his PhD and distinguish himself in the medical community. The test they devised aimed to trick a person's immune system into believing that it was infected with a deadly strain of E. coli. Under normal circumstances, once the immune system detects E. coli, it starts to produce antibodies and mounts an aggressive fever response to stop the infection before it spreads. People whose immune systems are already compromised, such as by a drug or sickness, continue on as if nothing happened. So the test he devised for Hoff was simple. He'd inject him with the dead bacteria and see how he responded. As I mentioned in Chapter 1, when the team injected the solution into Hoff's bloodstream, he showed almost no reaction at all. A result that astounded the scientists and helped earn Cox an award for his PhD dissertation on anti-inflammatory pathways. If the results held up to scrutiny, there would be enormous implications for anyone suffering from an autoimmune disease. However, the scientific community was far from willing to admit to a medical breakthrough or start rewriting textbooks. The first and most prevalent criticism of Pickers and Cox's study was that perhaps Hoff was just a genetic anomaly. Sure, maybe Hoff could affect his immune system, but he was probably just an exception to the rule, some sort of freak of nature, not a miracle worker. So, in 2012, Pickers and Cox designed a second experiment. This time, they wouldn't test Hoff. Instead, they would tell him to teach other people his technique and see if those students achieved similar results. At first blush, you would think that locating 30 people to volunteer for a bacterial injection that makes 99% of people feel terrible would be an uphill battle. But when the Dutch researchers announced the impending study at a university campus and told students that they would have a chance to study with Wim Hof, they fielded more applications than they knew how to handle. The study split volunteers into two groups. 12 people in the control group would go about their normal lives in Holland, while the second group of 18 would travel to Poland to study Hof's techniques of ice baths and breathing for 10 days. Predictably, nobody wanted to be in the control group. So Hoff volunteered to teach his methods to the people in the control group, those who wouldn't go to Poland, after the test was over. 1 week after I left Poland after summiting Mount Snezka, three instructors flew to the farmhouse and Hoff taught the active group three basic techniques: cold exposure in the snow, focused third eye meditation, and sequential muscle retention after hyperventilation. They climbed up the same mountain that I did and baked in the same sauna. When they returned from their trip, the volunteers continued to practice on their own for 5 days before showing up at Pickers and Cox's lab for supervised injections. The results were astonishing. Even after such a short training program, the active group showed positive levels of epinephrine, as well as an increased amount of anti-inflammatory molecules in their blood. They had fewer fever-like symptoms than the control group experienced, and their cortisol levels returned to normal much quicker. To quote the subsequent journal article from the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science, "Hitherto, both the autonomic nervous system and the innate immune system were regarded as systems that cannot be voluntarily influenced. The present study demonstrates that through practicing techniques learned in a short-term training program, the sympathetic nervous systems and immune system can indeed be voluntarily influenced." This short declarative statement forced the scientific community to completely re-evaluate their understanding of the immune system. The article earned a mention on the journal Nature's website and caught fire across the internet, lending scientific credibility to Wim Hof's program. If the finding continues to hold up to scientific scrutiny, then it would seem to have potential implications for a huge variety of illnesses. From autoimmune conditions, to diabetes, to bacterial infections, to food allergies, to, well, anything. If not an actual cure for any of these, environmental stimulation adds an important dynamic to the overall picture for treating human illness. A year later, a related but unaffiliated anatomical discovery helped shed light on how conscious control of the immune system might work. For the most part, the immune system has a standard operating procedure for uncovering and destroying foreign invaders. Once it locates a virus, tumor, bacteria, or, in the past 60 years, transplanted organs, It sends out white blood cells to eat the pathogens or explode the sick cells. The process is essentially the same in every part of the body, except for the brain. If an infection breaches the blood-brain barrier, think meningitis, the body has no defense against invading bacteria. Presumably, evolution was to blame. The brain was simply too fragile to allow the immune system to meddle inside of it. More importantly, there appeared to be a firewall between them. Every anatomical textbook posited that the immune system, or more specifically the lymphatic system, and the brain were completely separate and had no physical connections. However, in 2005, Jonathan Kipnis, a neuroscientist at the University of Virginia, noticed that mice with severely degraded immune systems also suffered from severe cognitive impairment. He discovered that mice with low T-cell counts forgot to run through mazes that they used to traverse with ease. He also learned that if he boosted their immune systems, their mental abilities improved. This led him to hypothesize that there must be a connection between the immune system and overall brain function, and that perhaps comprised health could explain the cognitive decline of people with HIV or dementia. But the findings puzzled Kipnis, because they contradicted the notion that the brain and immune system were separate. Even though he could show that the brain wasn't working well with a compromised immune system, there was no anatomical reason for that to be the case. So, he did what any good biologist would do in his position. He began dissecting mice. In 2014, Kipnis started to look at the vertebrae along mouse and human spines for any sort of gateway where T cells might come into contact with the central nervous system. There, he discovered small, fluid-filled lymph nodes that should not have been there. They didn't appear in any medical literature, and he realized instantly that he'd made a major discovery. New anatomical discoveries are incredibly rare in the modern age. Doctors have been dissecting humans and mapping internal anatomy at least since the time of Leonardo da Vinci. But these sacs connected directly into the spinal cord and served to drain lymph from the central nervous system. In 2015, the most prestigious scientific journal in the world, Nature, published his findings with a call to rewrite medical literature, stating, "The presence of a functional and classical lymphatic system in the central nervous system suggests that current dogmas regarding brain tolerance and immune privilege of the brain should be revisited." For the first time, it was clear that the brain and body were not so different after all. Without a barrier between the two, even the most reticent researchers have to admit that it is at least possible that people might be able to consciously affect their immune systems. Indeed, as Kipnis initially suspected, medical literature is full of examples of how schizophrenia and even something as mild as psychological stress can make people more vulnerable to immune problems. Why couldn't that communication travel in the other direction? A person in good spirits and environmental balance should be able to get an immune benefit. The strangest thing about these scientific discoveries is that outside the strict confines of the Ivory Tower journals, the thought wasn't really a revolution. It's something that we knew all along. Chapter 8: It's Raining Inside. No one notices when the first drops of water begin to form on the ceiling. I am standing in the upstairs shower, warming in a cascade of hot water after my morning dip in Hoff's ice-cold pool. The house is a brand new acquisition to the Iceman business, and there are still a few kinks to work out. One of which is that the drain in the middle of the bathroom floor tends to get clogged with debris. As I stand there, oblivious to the potential problem, water pools in the center of the room until it overflows a marble threshold tile and then spills out into the hallway. From there, it follows the will of gravity, slipping between the cracks in the wood and seeping into the space between the subfloor and the downstairs ceiling. The soapy water collects in the cavity until it saturates the materials below. When Hoff bursts into the bathroom, my first thought is that he somehow knew that I dared heat myself up in a shower, and that he is going to scold me until I turn the faucet to a temperature that will shock my nervous system into submission. Instead, he yells at me in a mixture of Dutch and English before pushing me aside and turning off the knob. It is only my second day in Holland, and I've already flooded his brand new house. I wrap myself in a towel and head down the staircase to survey the damage myself. Hundreds of droplets hang precariously from the ceiling. Each slowly elongates until it grows too heavy and comes splashing down into the middle of his living room. They pepper the sofa, his guitar, and his television. Hoff's dog, Xena, barks happily at the impromptu rainstorm. There are three of us in the room, me, Hoff, and a red-headed American alkalite named Anton Nikola, who has just finished a recent winter training session in Poland. Together, we push furniture out of the way and scrounge rags and towels from the bare closets to sop up the deluge. Minutes pass, and if anything, the storm just grows stronger. A knot forms in my stomach when I realize that the ceiling might collapse. It's all my fault, but when I look over at Hoff, he is standing in the middle of the torrent with his hands raised over his head. A broad smile beams across his face when he starts shouting, "It's a miracle! Can you believe that it's raining inside my house? What luck!" Hoff dances amid the droplets, letting the water fall where it might, like some sort of deranged rain god. It's not the sort of reaction I expect, or that I would mete out to one of my own guests in the same situation. But for Hoff, the destruction of his home marks an inexplicable moment of joy. Jump back to a few days earlier. It is Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, when all America participates in a communal shopping orgy as they open their wallets, unable to resist the lure of discounted consumer goods. For the previous month, I've kept the thermostat at my house at a steady 62 degrees, a full 10 degrees lower than the year before, when my wife used to chide me that I was perfectly happy to hole up in my office with the space heater on. It has been almost 4 years since I'd first met Hoff. Although I have become better at my practice since the summer began, I must confess that my training program since first meeting Hoff in Poland could politely be termed irregular. Some mornings I wake up and fall effortlessly into breathless breathing routines with a cold shower finish, while other times it is so much easier to wipe the sleep from my eyes, pour a cup of coffee, and move on to other things. Once the habit is broken and the days march forward, it can sometimes take a week before I take it up again. Who am I kidding? It might be a month. Perhaps that's the reason I book a ticket to see Hoff.